You are listening to Vueltas y Revueltas, the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 12. Today, we are in Córdoba.
I don't gather that it rains here very often, so I think the roads are a bit dirty. I also heard something that 25% of the olive trees in the world are in this area. 20%, okay.
Well, we open tonight's episode with Joe Dombrowski and a live corrections corner, Danny Friberico, out there in Spain. Hello, Daniel Frieb. You were correcting Joe and his olive tree statistic.
Well, I was correcting him, Richard, fairly confidently. And we've had more various other statistics to embellish and add to what I mentioned last night about Jaén, the province of Jaén's olive oil, that it accounts for 20% of the world's olive oil, more than the second largest olive oil producing country, Italy. I'm just reading a Financial Times article I've got in front of me. Jaén is responsible for 40% of Spain's olive oil and a fifth of the world's.
Impeccable sourcing.
I think we can keep this going until the end of the world, though. We'll just turn it into a province of Jaén olive oil podcast.
We're also joined by Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard. I'm wondering whether we're going to get somebody curating a collection of Spanish olive oils for us to sell in the cycling podcast shop. I'd certainly buy some.
Yeah, it's an idea.
I must add, chaps, that all of this talk stemmed from speculation about what caused that rather curious crash with about 50 kilometres to go today, when a couple of riders unfortunately did a bit of a Johnny Hoogaland and ended in a barbed wire fence, Nelson Oliveira being one and Dylan Van Baarle the other. Are actually awaiting news of both of those riders tonight and how badly injured they are. But there was some talk that there was the roads were slippery because of the olive oil. I don't see how that can happen.
Well, olives can fall onto the road and then get squashed by cars, and then, hey presto, you've got some extra virgin olive oil on the road surface. No, I mean, it could happen.
It did look like a touch of wheels, however, putting paid to the olive oil theory. But the riders might well feel that the roads are slippy, but I don't think that was the cause of that crash.
It's a very 21st century cycling kind of problem, isn't it? You know, once upon a time, potholes and engine oil used to cause
grease.
But oh no, now it's extra virgin olive oil.
It's just a sign of
tapenade when they ride in Provence.
Oh dear. We shouldn't be flippant about what was a pretty nasty crash, and one that affected quite a few important riders in this race. Dylan Van Baarle as well finished last on the stage, didn't he? And he looked to be in pretty bad way. He's had a nasty crash at the Vuelta before. Do you remember when he finished second on the stage a couple of years ago, and he was one of the three riders who crashed into the race official just beyond the finish line and had to head home then as well? So hopefully he's okay.
I was talking about that stage with a colleague the other day, Rich. Can you remember who won that stage? I haven't looked it up.
An AG2R rider, Genies, I think. I'll check that as we go. But while I'm checking that, Lionel, can you give us the tale of the etapa, please?
I can
and
indeed.
It was Genies.
Oh, well done.
Breaking news.
It was.
Guess who was third that day? Mark Padun.
Oh, there we wow. Go. A very young Mark Padun, it must have been.
Wait, yeah. How long ago was that? 2019 or 2018?
2018.
Well, today, back to the present. Stage 12 of the 2021 Vuelta from Jaén to Córdoba. And, well, we're witnessing the 3 days of Magnus Cort, really, aren't we? Because a couple of days ago, he featured in that big break. Yesterday, he was caught within touching distance of the line after another magnificent attack. And today, he won a bunch sprint. Sort of going back to his day job, because his first couple of Vuelta stages were bunch sprints, including, I think, one in Madrid. I think I'm right in saying. Yes, and what a sprint it was. I mean, it was a sprint with some non-sprinters getting involved and certainly some non-lead-out experts getting involved. And, we'll dissect the sprint a little bit later, but there were a couple of significant breaks before all that happened. It took a long time today for the break to go clear. Initially, there was an escape of three riders with 97 kilometres to go. They were Mikel Iturria of Euskaltel, Sebastian Berick of Israel Startup Nation. I hope I've said Berwick right. That's the kind of the British or Scottish or north of England pronunciation of Berwick. And Sander Armé of Quebeca. And they were then joined by Stander Wolf, Yetzer Boll, Amez Coeta, Maxim Van Kiels and Chad Hager of DSM on his 33rd birthday. And they were away for quite a lot of the stage. UAE Team Emirates were doing most of the heavy lifting on the front of the peloton for Matteo Trentin, who obviously fancied his chances for the stage. As you mentioned, chaps, there was that nasty crash on a bit of a descent with 55 kilometres to go. The three teams worst affected, Jumbo-Visma, Ineos Grenadiers and Movistar, all had riders on the ground. And as you say, Richard, it was Nelson Oliveira who had some really badly shredded shorts and Dylan Van Baarle who looked like they came off worse. With 47 kilometres to go, Ituria tried to go clear on his own, but then he was caught and the gap was coming down as they went through the finish line because they did a big finishing loop to go over the final climb. We saw Van Hiels go ahead solo. Behind him, Jonathan Lastra, who was in the break yesterday, attacked the bunch, but everything was brought back together with 21 kilometres to go on the final climb. And then there was a second attack, and a significant one. It featured the Zwift Academy winner, Jay Vine, he earned a contract with Alpecin Phoenix, didn't he, by winning the Zwift Academy last year. He was joined by Giulio Ciccone of Trek Segafredo, and then Romain Bardet bridged up, and then finally Sergio Henao of Quebeca joined them. So that was a quartet who were away. Significantly on the climb, Michael Matthews and Magnus Cort were dropped and in a bit of difficulty. On the descent, Trentin's enthusiasm seemed to get the better of him a bit. He found himself off the front and was joined by Jon Izagirre of Astana, and they didn't know really whether to go for it or not. They actually sat up as it flattened out. Then a fearless chase between the break, the quartet out in front, and the bunch after Trentin and Izagirre were caught. Bike Exchange were doing all of the chasing for Mike Matthews, and with a couple of kilometres to go, the lead was still 10 seconds. And just as they came to the Flam Rouge with a kilometre to go, Jay Vine used his power up. That's a Zwift joke, a Zwift
well,
reference,
Well, I'm saying with his late attack, Lionel, I think he earned himself a new set of sunglasses and a pair of track mitts.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
And he's moved up a level.
It's funny, chaps. I was speaking to another rider this morning whose identity I won't disclose. It will be revealed in the next few days, for whom Zwift was very instrumental in securing them a pro, a World Tour contract, in fact.
Wasn't Jay Vine, was it, Daniel?
Well, I mean, he looked great, didn't he? I mean, he held them off for, you know, quite a long time, as you say. Yeah, the new sunglasses. Didn't have time.
Look forward to seeing his new track mitts tomorrow.
He didn't have time to switch to the Tron bike. Maybe that would have been all the difference. I don't know. I'm not joking about Zwift. You know, there's a serious story there about getting a position in the pro peloton after impressing in indoor cycling, static indoor cycling. Anyway, Vine was caught, and then we saw the sprint. It was quite an interesting one. We'll hear from Matteo Trentin about the run-in, but Bike Exchange did seem to lose control of it a little bit. Magnus Cort had his teammate Jens Kukalera, who Richard reminded me before we started recording, won a Welter sprint finish in Bilbao a few years ago. Kukalera, well, it was the perfect lead out. Cort came off his wheel, and although Andrea Bagioli of De Koenig Quickstep really pushed him very hard, the Dane held on to win, I mean, a really unlikely stage win given what he did yesterday and how close he came to holding on that really steep finish. So Magnus Cort got his second stage win in the end.
You are listening to Vueltas y Revueltas, the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. We're going to hear again from Asger Jurkendrup, the sports scientist and nutritionist for Jumbo-Visma, and he also works with Super Sapiens. You can find out about Super Sapiens on their website, supersapiens.com. But let's hear from Asger about how this technology can help riders of all levels with their fueling and their training.
Riders do see it as a potential game changer, but at the same time, they of course want to have the answers straight away. And I think we do need a little bit of time to collect the data so we can give more meaningful advice. And over time, you can see that riders will learn about how their body responds. It's not something that you're going to get after 2 weeks of wearing a sensor. You just need to wear it for longer. You need to do your own little experiments. And that sometimes also is not easy in free living conditions, because glucose is influenced by what you eat. It is influenced by stress. It is influenced by your activity patterns or your training, but it's also influenced by the combination of those. For example, eating and training, the combined effect of that is different than the effects of eating alone and then training alone.
Well, Lionel, you said that Bike Exchange lost control in the final. They didn't really do much wrong, though, did they? I mean, it was a really impressive kind of full, I think they had the full team up there working to help Matthews and bring back a pretty strong breakaway that you know, had every possibility of staying clear. They looked strong. Bike Exchange had to do an awful lot to bring them back and really didn't do much wrong. It was a moment of sort of improvised brilliance from Jens Kukulair, I thought, to go when he went, because, I mean, he's a great sprinter in his own right. He's won a bunch sprint before. What a lead out man for Magnus Cort to have. And he just jumped and got that little gap. Bagioli was kind of quick onto them, but Matthews just behind and couldn't close that gap. And yeah, he looked absolutely distraught as he crossed the line, because his team had put so much effort into it, and he's put an awful lot of effort into trying to win a stage at this Vuelta, and it just hasn't come off for him.
No, I mean, you know, the conventional thing about a lead out is that the whole point is that the pace is supposed to be high enough to prevent those kind of moves, isn't it? I suppose.
True.
I mean, not taking anything away from Kukulair, but there was obviously a gain to be made, and he read it perfectly, judged it perfectly, and executed perfectly. And what I suppose fascinates me is, given what Cort did yesterday, and that Kukulair is a decent sprinter in his own right, I mean, quite some trust being put in Cort there to say, you know, he must have put his hand up and said, look, I can go for this, I'm quick enough, I'm strong enough to win this sprint finish.
Well, Lionel, I actually got some intel on this from our colleague Hugo Kordovits, who arrived a couple of days ago, the Het Nieuwsblad writer, and he spoke to Jens Kukulair, gave him a call after the finish, and indeed Magnus Cort said that he didn't feel good, or he was telling Jens Kukulair throughout the stage that he wasn't feeling very good at all, and that Jens Kukulair should sprint, and Kukulair eventually convinced him that no, they should go for Magnus Cort. These two are very good friends, and they rode together at Mitchelton Scott. In fact, Kukulair led out some sprints, I think, for Magnus Cort when they were both there, and Kukulair said that he'd never been as emotional after a race. You know, he's won a lot of races himself, but he was absolutely thrilled that his teammate had won. And I just thought that it was perhaps to their advantage that they didn't have many men EF Education First compared to Bike Exchange and UAE, who had a lot of guys, but they were not specialist lead out men. And it was quite simple, actually, what EF Education First did. Kukulair had picked his moment because the peloton had come through the finishing line before it was a finishing lap today. Kukulair had identified the point the first time that he went through where he was going to launch the sprint, about 600 to go or 650. And that's what he did. And it was a really powerful lead out he did from there. I mean, that's further than a lead out man would usually go from. But in these circumstances, you know, a reduced bunch, not too many lead out trains around, then yeah, it did the job perfectly. It was also slightly uphill. In fact, I'm sitting next to the finishing straight at the moment. And it's, you know, it goes up at I would say 3 or 4%. Very, very impressive, I agree.
Magnus Cort is just in terrific form, isn't he? And when you're in that sort of form, it's you can do anything. And the Vuelta is perhaps a race where somebody in that sort of form can be really handsomely rewarded, because a lot of riders maybe aren't in great form. It's not a race that an awful lot of riders actually really train for, you know? He rode the Tour de France as well, Magnus Cort. And often when riders are in this kind of form at the Vuelta, it's almost Baxton. We saw that with Hugh Carthy last year.
He almost said that, Rich, in the press conference after the stage. He said that he really did not expect to come here in particularly good form. I think he'd had a fair amount of time, not off, but his training hadn't been that intensive between the Tour and the Vuelta. And he surprised himself in the first week that he really felt fantastic.
He reminds me here of Matteo Trentin a few years ago when he came to the Vuelta in similar form and just couldn't stop winning. He was winning bunch sprints and it looked like he could just do just about anything. That was 2017, and Trentin was one of the riders in contention today. His team also put an awful lot into the chase. His team perhaps not got the sort of personnel that Bike Exchange have for setting him up, but they did their best, didn't they, today? And you spoke to him at the finish, Daniel.
I did, Rich, and what you'll hear first of all, well, I hope this is bleeped out, because there was some fairly colourful language from Matteo Trentin, but there was a very good-natured moment where Magnus Cort appeared alongside him. That explains Matteo Trentin's sort of, well, expletive in his direction. And then we'll also hear from Joe Dombrowski, UAE rider, obviously a climber, about why the team decided to commit today and put so many resources into trying to bring the race back together for that sprint.
No, we got just outclassed. I mean, we got one of the climbers in front, and they did an amazing job for me, setting the tempo, wait for me when I was behind. And of course, it's not lead out team. Yeah, the guys over here have just timed me perfectly, and I have to say Bike Exchange up quite a lot in the last roundabout. It's racing, and if Nick Schuss was going straight, then we maybe we're talking something else, but this is racing and that's it. If someone on the GC was trying and taking some times, of course David has to manage his own thing. Yeah, to be honest, it was obvious. They were going on the hard part, so I just have to pace myself. I found Matthews on the way up. We just paced together.
The Vuelta, from what I've seen, it always has like two types of climbs. Either they're quite fast and shallow, or they're like crazy steep. So either they're climbs that the sprinters can sometimes pass, one that can climb like Matteo, or they really favor explosive riders. So we watched yesterday Bike Exchange try and pull for Matthews. I thought it was a little bit ambitious, but we thought today's climbs were a little bit easier. Actually, one of the hardest parts of the stage was the start, because it took almost 90k for the break to go. To try and control that, because it's a lot more work for us if there's a group of 12 guys up front, then it gets to be where with only three guys pulling, it's going to be difficult to bring it back.
Well, Chaz, that was interesting from Joe Dombrowski. I should also inform you that, as well as the olive oil banter, there was some pretty puerile but quite funny talk about boom poles and the length of boom poles from Joe Dombrowski in the mix zone today. It was quite a job getting him to stop laughing and concentrate on what happened.
Were they being stuck up his nose, or rather, yeah. Because there was a moment the other day where Sam Omen had to ask for it to be withdrawn ever so slightly, because it was on the verge of literally disappearing up his nose.
No, I think it was even more immature than that, Rich, the chat. So I think we should gloss over it. As regards Trentin, I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I do feel he's a bit impetuous and he doesn't trust himself enough. And this was in stark contrast today with Magnus Cort, who really was stayed. hidden in the bunch. And again, you know, as we said,
Daniel, hang on. You're trying to say here that the Italian was tempestuous and the Dane was ice cool. This is
stereotyping that we don't indulge in, really.
Groundbreaking
stuff. This is
some
claim.
But I had flashbacks when Trentin was chasing those moves, that move by Jon Izagirre, and even the fact that David de la Cruz went off the front briefly on the final descent. I had flashbacks to some of the San Remos that Matteo Trentin has tried and not succeeded in winning. When, you know, off the bottom or off the back of the Poggio, he's often been distracted. I mean, I say often, it's probably two or three times at most. But he does, you know, I think it often he's so strong, he's not a pure sprinter, and he knows that he's got a couple of options in finales of 30, 40, 50 guys. He has won races before. I think he won a stage in the Tour de France by going alone in the finale of a stage. So he has options. He doesn't have to wait for the sprint. But I think sometimes that might be to his detriment a little bit.
Yeah, caught between two different approaches, either of which would have been valid. Caught between them. Yeah.
Magnus Corp.
But either of them would have been valid had they, you know, had full commitment. I mean, what do you think? Do you think when he found himself off the front, it looked like, as you say, Daniel, you know, it's just his legs carried him away and suddenly, because he was looking around a little bit, the gap was open, and he probably realised that it's quite a long push on from there on the flat. He would need help. He, you know, there wasn't a group coming away, and he was just sort of caught in the wrong place. I mean, probably, you know, maybe it was just a sort of shove of the door to see whether it would fall open for him.
I think it's a very shrewd analysis, though, because because he's got options, it means he's got, you know, lots of decisions to make. And if he was Michael Matthews, it's fairly obvious that he his best chance of winning is to be taken to the finish in a small group. Whereas Trentin, I mean, he won a stage of the Tour a couple of years ago with a long solo attack into Gap, didn't he? He has won races from bunch sprints. He's won races alone. And so he can't, you know, it was feasible today that he might have bridged up to that breakaway and then won from that small group. That was perhaps as good a chance he had of winning as it being a bunch sprint. So having those options doesn't make his job easier.
Yeah, and the best way I suppose I can describe it is by saying who he's not like and who he doesn't remind me of. And I would say it's someone like Oscar Freire, who, you know, obviously retired a few years ago now, but he was someone who you didn't see until the final corner or the last 300 metres. Yet he was someone, and he illustrated this kind of ironically, his first big win was in the World Championships in 1999 in Verona, when he came into the finish in a group of about eight, and he went with 600 metres to go, which with hindsight he didn't need to do at all. He could have waited for the sprint, but for the rest of his career, Freire was an absolute master of knowing that he was probably strong enough to go away, whether it was solo on climbs or you know, in small groups. But he would generally wait for the right moment and wait for the sprint, because he knew that if he did that and if he stayed in the wheel, stayed out of the wind, then he probably would be the fastest, particularly in smaller, you know, in sort of 80, 90, 100 man groups.
Yeah, the other thing that was interesting in what Matteo Trentin said about the run-in was his sort of critique of bike exchange. I mean, I said they lost control in the finishing straight, but he seemed to allude to them making perhaps some mistakes around a roundabout on the run-in. But we watched it back, didn't we, chaps? And I couldn't really see anything obvious. I mean, they're not going round perhaps full bore, taking the tightest possible line. They did look like they went round a couple of turns quite wide. But I couldn't really see anything that you could say was a, you know, a cast iron obvious moment where they dropped the ball bike exchange. But I guess that's the difficulty of trying to lead out a very accomplished sprinter with perhaps a lead out train that hasn't really worked together very much in the past. Some of them.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to our longtime sponsor, Science in Sport, who are still offering you, the listeners, 25% off all your Science in Sport products. Go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, enter the code SISCP25. Science and Sport offer a recycling service now, don't they, Lionel?
Yeah, they do. You can send your wrappings, your packaging, back to Science and Sport's partner for free, and it will be recycled. I mean, it's not a sort of widely recyclable material through traditional methods, apparently, but the plastic and aluminium layers from the gel wrappers are separated. The aluminium is then recovered for reprocessing. The plastics are then separated into gas and oil. The gas is used to power the whole process, and the oil can be used for future products or energy. And so it means nothing's just being buried in landfill, which has to be a good thing. So if anyone needs any encouragement to just make sure they take their Science and Sport gel wrappers and bar wrappers and so on home with them when they're on a ride, then I think that is it.
Moving back onto today's stage, and we're going to talk about the two top men on GC, I suppose, Enric Mas and Primož Roglič. Another little scare for Roglič today with the crash, but Mas looks like the real danger to Roglič, doesn't he? And Daniel, a factor in that may be Patxi Vila, the sports director at Movistar now, who joined the team last year from Bora Hansgrohe, where he had a very good reputation as a somebody who was a good sort of coach and developer of talent.
Mainly as a coach, wasn't it, Rich?
He was
coaching Peter Sagan.
Hmm. And he moved to Movistar last year and seemed to take a bit of a watching brief over the course of the year. It seems far more involved this year. And we're seeing it as well to a very strong Movistar performance and a very strong Enric Mas. And you spoke to him at the start today.
I did, Rich. I spoke to him about Enric Mas and how the Enric Mas of 2021 differs from the 2020 version.
Patxi, you were mainly watching the team last year at the Vuelta, I guess. Now you're in the first team car. How much has Enric changed? How different is he from the Enric Mas who rode his first season with Movistar last year?
We have changed some stuff around him. We kind of draw a plan and a path for him to try to, you know, fix the weaknesses. I see yesterday you could see a different Enric regarding last year, you know, more punchy, you know, also more aggressive, sticking to the wheel, Primož also in the race tactics, also, you know, being on where he has to be. So we love developing riders and we love just making them better. I think Movistar and Abarca and Eusebio Unzué, the owner, probably is the man with more experience in Grand Tours and the World Tour. And it's amazing what you can learn from him and how he can see things coming on the long way and the long run, you know. And simply we just try to okay, this is the rider now, this is the weakness, how can we fix this? And we have just, okay, step by step we go, you know. For example, this year, I think the Tour, Enric was much better than last year, but he had just two bad days, you know. Last year he was probably more consistent, more solid, but the level was even less. But we see also there in that too, we saw that was like kind of, we see, you know, a nice bright from him. So, okay, then probably we are on the way, you know. So, I mean, sometimes even if it you could see, it seems like you're stepping backwards, you know, you need something, step backwards just to, you know, to then make three or four frontwards, you know.
Been a hot Vuelta, and of course, last year the Grand Tours were at the end of the season, and the weather was completely different. Is that an advantage as well for Enric? He seems to go well in this weather.
Yeah, he loves warm conditions. He lives in Mallorca, you know, where he's born there, so probably his summers in Mallorca were pretty hot when he was young, and I think that it's something you carry on with your life, you know. When you're exposed to some weather conditions, that's something you have on your brain somewhere, and your muscles have also some kind of memory. So yeah, probably that's a small point on our side.
So that was Patxi Vila, chaps, really, well, telling us what we've already noticed, what we've already established, I suppose, ourselves, that the Enric Mas of 2021 is more aggressive, he seems more confident. He's definitely the biggest threat to Primož Roglič, I think everyone agrees going forward. And, you know, I was thinking about the stages to come earlier today, and there's a lot still to do for Primož Roglič. So a couple of mountain stages coming in Extremadura this week, and then the two really big Asturian mountain stages, Covadonga and El Gamonitero, the new Anglia route next week, and there are a few other stages as well which could cause damage. I mentioned the one in Galicia on the penultimate day. So Mass is by no means out of it, and neither is Superman Lopez. But I was speaking to some colleagues in the press room earlier, and we were reflecting on the fact that, sort of jokes aside, and there's a lot of kind of mirth about Movistar, most of it unfair, that the absence of Marc Soler, first of all, and then Alejandro Valverde, it strikes me that it's kind of simplified things for Movistar, because they're sort of down to their bare bones as far as tactics are concerned. They're down to Carlos Verona, sort of as the mountain domestique, to a lesser extent Nelson Oliveira, and then they've got Imanol Erviti and Rojas as well, who will look after the two leaders, Superman and Mass, on the flat. But it doesn't really leave them many options. And where Movistar have sort of made people titter and mock them over the past two or three years has been on those mixed stages when they've tried to send guys down the road, and particularly Soler, and people have been told to wait and they've not wanted to wait, or they've done the wrong thing with Valverde. And what they've got to do here, I mean, I know today they had another blow with Oliveira crashing, and well, we hope that he heals up and can be of service over the next few days. But what they've got to do here is really very simple with only six men. It perhaps limits them, but it means that they've just got to follow Roglic and be there at the foot of the final climb and hope that Mass and Superman can outclimb him. I mean, that's how I see it. I don't know about you guys.
So I saw someone ask on social media the other day whether anybody had taken Alejandro Valverde's seat in the bus, that throne right behind the driver's seat. I don't know if you can find that out, Daniel. Just on Mass, on Enric Mass, anybody who watched the Movistar Netflix series that we talk about a lot will have been struck by how serious he is, how hard he is on himself as well. You know, that came across in the second series. You know, when he had that podium finish at the Vuelta in 2018, he looked like being the sort of Spanish champion in waiting. It was Alberto Contador's last Vuelta, and it looked as if, as Contador was exiting the stage, here was Enric Mas ready to replace him. He had another year with De Koenig Quickstep in 2019, but the deal was done pretty early for him to move to Movistar. 2019, he didn't make progress, didn't have a great season, and you wondered whether this star in whom Movistar were investing would actually live up to that billing. And his progress since then has been very gradual, but in a positive sort of direction. You know, 2020 was a good year for him, and 2021 looks like being a better year for him on current form. And I think that he is a really serious challenger to Roglic. That was apparent yesterday on that climb up to the finish, which was very short and, you know, was absolutely made for Roglic. But Mass took him on, and once we get to Lagos de Covadonga, that on that sort of climb, perhaps Mass and Lopez together could combined quite well against Roglic there, you know, if it's just the three of them, and perhaps Jack Haig as well, as we sort of expect.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, Movistar are going to have to address the fact that there is a time trial to end this race. And I know we've talked about, you know, maybe Roglic being a little bit vulnerable towards the end of races. We've seen that before. He's obviously lost the Tour de France in a mountain time trial right at the death to Tadej Pogacar last year. But head-to-head, Roglic has really got a serious edge over Mass, and an even bigger edge, really, historically, over Lopez. So Movistar have to nudge in front of him by, well, how much is, the second part of the question. First of all, they have to work out a way to try to get in front of Roglic on GC, and their best chances is going to be on the long, steady climbs, I guess. The ambush idea is the longest shot, especially as Movistar's resources are dwindling. Daniel, you say they're down to the bare bones. They really would be if Oliveira is either unable to continue or unable to continue at the required level. So it's a really big weekend coming up for Movistar. I think they need to start making that move on Saturday, really. There's a long uphill finish You know, it's straightforward racing. They've got to try and put Jumbo-Visma and Roglic under some pressure and see if something gives, because otherwise they will start running out of days and they'll stand on the podium, perhaps at the finish in second and third place, wondering, well, what if we'd really turn the screw? I mean, it's so easy to say that, but they do have to get in front of him, don't they?
Well, they do and they don't. I think it would be naive to think that second and third wouldn't be a fantastic result for Movistar, and I don't think they're going to risk everything to try to dethrone Primoz Roglic. I really don't. You know, we mentioned the 2015 Tour de France where they finished second and third with Valverde and Quintana. You know, it's a team that targets general classification generally, well, famously, infamously targets team classification as well, but they're not a team that looks at the number of wins they've had at the end of the season. And you know, I think if they are big factors in the race, which they have been up until this point, and if on a personal developmental level, Superman and Enric Mas, who are the future of this team, Superman has just signed on for another 2 years and Mas has got a long-term contract. If they're moving forward, then I think they'll be happy. I mean, already, I think Mas has allayed some of their, what might have been their fears, that he's plateaued, stagnating. At the Tour de France, you know, he looked able to follow until there were five or six guys left, and then he would always get dropped, and he wasn't really able to affect the race in the mountains on the front end. And that's changed here. And I think, as Rich said, that's a flashback. That's a reminder of the Mass we first saw in 2018. And I think that's the one that they invested in. That's the one they believed was going to be the next Alberto Contador, the next big star in Spanish cycling. So I think, you know, they'll be absolutely thrilled that he's back on that path.
He's flying the flag for Spanish cycling at the moment. There hasn't been a Spanish stage win in this Vuelta yet. So, you know, a lot of Spanish hopes invested in Mas, perhaps to become the first Spanish stage winner in this race as well.
He's also impressed me, chaps, at this Vuelta by being a lot cheerier than in the past couple of years. Rich, you said he seems a very serious character, you know, on the team bus and when it comes to racing. And I remember speaking to Carlos Verona earlier in the year, and he confirmed that the Mas is, you know, he's very focused and he can be quite sort of poker-faced at times, but he's been in good mood with the media. Well, as have a few riders here, chaps, and Primoz Roglic being the most flagrant example. Maybe we should have the Daily Rog. Maybe we should hear from Primoz, hear what he had to say this morning in, where were we this morning? Jaén. And I should just say that Roglic is being asked a lot. This is a bit meta. He's being asked a lot about why he is in such a good mood at the Vuelta. And he is invariably responding, you know, in a very good-natured fashion, as he did this morning.
I don't know. Maybe not. I don't care, actually. Now I'm here. I try to enjoy it, try to do my best. We see how far and what we can achieve. When you force it, it's hard to achieve it. So it has to come naturally. That you come and you just enjoy it.
Primoz, is this the Grand Tour where you feel most at home? Is it your favorite one because of the roads? I don't know, the weather, the people?
It seems like, yeah. I don't want never to really pick this and this and this, but yeah, obviously it seems like, looking on results, definitely I like Vuelta.
Back in the past, the Spanish fans, they used to hate foreign riders. They used to spit at them, throw things at them, but they seem to like you.
Hopefully, at least I like them. It's nice. The people, yes, gives us great support. So we are enjoying it.
So there you go, chaps. The ROG stand-up tour of France continues. Spain.
I mean, being asked if you're in a good mood is likely to put you in a good mood, isn't it? Like, being asked why are you in a bad mood is likely to put you in a bad mood. So there's a sort of virtuous circle there.
He still manages to stay true to character, and he still adds that sort of stoical, I don't really care, huh? I don't really care if I'm in a good mood, huh?
I mean, Rog will be even more delighted and in an even better mood when he hears your analysis, Daniel, and realises that Movistar are just playing for a home draw.
I mentioned Mas not being the most sort of expansive interviewee earlier, but it's easy. Well, I think none of us forget, because some of us were slightly traumatised by how difficult it used to be just 2 or 3 years ago to interview Primoz Roglic, and it's a real credit to him and a credit to his team as well, Jumbo Visma, for the way they have managed him and eased him into what is part of his job and has become a bigger and bigger part of his job, because he spent so much time in leaders' jerseys having to attend to the post-race protocol. It's a sort of case study that you would show young riders who don't find that part of the job easy, and a lot of them don't, at how just by taking yourself out of your comfort zone and just exposing yourself to it and trying to be good-natured in interviews, it really takes the stress out of it. And Rog, you know, appears every morning, he sits on his crossbar, that's not right, top tube, I'm supposed to call it. He sits on his top tube and he just holds court, and, you know, he does so with a smile on his face. And it's in stark contrast to the Rog of 2 or 3 years ago. And as I say, I think it's removed a lot of unnecessary stress from his existence as a perennial leader of Grand Tours.
In those years of Rog being the toughest interview, his teammates and people on the team always said how funny and relaxed he was behind closed doors. And I think over time, he's just gradually revealed a bit more of that self. Perhaps he feels more confident, perhaps he sees familiar faces, you know, that he has developed a bit of a rapport with, I don't know. But he's also been put in that position so much now, you know, put in front of microphones and cameras, that maybe it was inevitable that self that he has shown to his teammates has become more apparent, has sort of come out.
There are some riders, chaps, though, aren't there? And you guys know this all too well, that there are some riders who never soften.
And there are some that get worse as they get older.
Yes. And again, we've talked about the benefit, the sort of sweet spot, I think, of being from where he's from Slovenia. And I just get the sense that the media attention and also the public attention and adulation from Slovenia is at a very sort of beneficial, quite enjoyable level for Rog. It doesn't lurch into sort of unpleasant scrutiny.
But I think also though, Daniel, you know, something that became apparent to me was how people in Slovenia, his main constituency perhaps, have really embraced the Rog as, you know, and his reputation was perhaps confirmed at the tour last year, the tour that he lost. The guy who overcomes adversity, who recovers from great disappointments and setbacks, who never gives up, who keeps trying. And, you know, in that little interview I had with him in the other Slovenians, the Kilometer Zero that we put out last week, it was quite interesting that he said that he recognized that his popularity owes quite a lot to people relating to that story and connecting with it. And he seemed quite conscious of that people, and even the other day, you know, when he crashed and he was very stoic about it and almost upbeat about it, it was almost another chapter in the now familiar Roglic story of it never being plain sailing. There always being setbacks, wobbles in the road that he has to overcome. That's part of who he is, and it's part of the story that he recognises people like in him.
The other thing that I find interesting, Rich, you mentioned that stoicism. It's kind of the time, but also not, in the sense that often sportsmen and women, particularly at the moment, are lauded for showing their vulnerability. But on the other hand, there's part of the public or part of our sensibilities that also hankers for, craves, or really admires someone who is bulletproof and who, I mean, Roglic has also shown some vulnerability. He's shown vulnerability in his performances, but in terms of his attitude and the way he bounces back from adversity, I think there's a part of all of us who would like to integrate and assimilate a bit more of that, you know, Roglicism into our own lives.
Well, of course, Kate Wagner has written extensively about this, and let's not forget too that he lost the Tour de France in agonizing fashion last year, but in the moment of that defeat, in the moment of his most crushing disappointment, he reacted with great grace and humanity towards his vanquisher, Tadej Pogacar. You know, the way that he responded was reflected very well on him. And I think that also was is something that made people, more people, warm to him. Well, Daniel, somebody who has shown vulnerability is Gino Mader. And we hear a bit of that in the interview that we're about to hear from him that you did with him.
Yes, Rich, I spoke to Gino, caught up with him, our old audio diary, of course, our audio diary at the Giro, which for him was sadly curtailed by a crash. But I caught up with him in Roquetas de Mar, surrounded by all of those greenhouses we talked about the other day. It's been a great Vuelta a España for Gino Mader, who, I must admit, really impressed me at the Vuelta last year when he was still riding for NTT, switched to Bahrain Victorious this year, and he is, well, he's a vital cog in the Bahrain Victorious machine, helping Jack Haig on the mountain stages, but also managing to stay well up there on general classification. In fact,
he's 13th.
I spoke to him a couple of days ago, as I said, about his Vuelta so far and whether his role had changed after Mikel Landa's difficult day on the Alto de Velefique.
I guess yesterday you guys had a little bit of a, well, you reassessed things about tactics, and did anything change? Does anything change for you personally, and what's your job is going to be?
Same job as beginning of the race, just different rider. I'll try to protect, but same game for me.
And I guess you're really happy with the way the Vuelta's gone so far. I mean, how much do you think you've grown just in the last 3 or 4 months?
I think the most has actually happened the last like 2 years, when I had a lot of injuries, also being sick and missing a lot of part, and there has most of my growing has actually been done there. And now just the last few months I got more stable, like things have just been more stable for me, and that, you know, shows in the results, and kind of nice.
And confidence, I guess, from the outside looking in, seems like everyone in the team is very confident, and you have probably become more confident as well in the last 3 or 4 months. You know that you belong here.
Some days I do, others I don't. Like, take stage 6, I was just struggling all day. I was suffering so much to, yeah, be there. I lose 1.5 minutes in a 2K climb, which is a lot, by all means. And then you have stages like Sunday, when I can do my job, when I can stay with my mates. I feel I'm where I belong to, and nice. It's nice to have good days.
Well, interesting to hear from Gino Mader. What I meant when I said about his vulnerability is it's quite rare to hear a rider who's in, you know, fighting for the top 10, really. He's not too far off a top 10 position. You know, from the outside, it looks like he's having a great Vuelta, riding very strongly, but he admitted there to, you know, almost having a bit of imposter syndrome himself on days, wondering whether he really does belong up there. And it's always interesting to hear a rider or any athlete admit that.
I bring that out of riders, Rich. You know, I touch their most tender nerves.
You get on their nerves, you said.
Yeah.
It's something you're famous for, Daniel. It's great that you were able to carve Gino Mader open like that and let him. Who are you gonna tackle tomorrow?
Well, I don't know. We're talking of carving things open. I'm looking forward to sampling some local cuisine tonight in Cordoba,
nice segue.
Of course. Oh, yeah, there we go. Class. yeah, I'm looking forward to trying these flamenquines cordobeses. Flamenca, you'll recognize the root of that, flamenquines. Various different theories about where the name comes from. But they're kind of like, Lionel, you've had cachopo before, haven't you, in Asturias? You can probably describe it better than me. It's, what is it? Is it cordon bleu? Is it referred to as cordon bleu?
It's kind
bleu,
of, isn't it? It's
very thinly
sliced steak that then is bread crumbed, isn't it? And it's got cheese and ham on the top. So it's sort of an after a cider type meal, really, rather than a sort of gourmet dinner. It's a bit of a kebab shop really, isn't it? I mean, it's enjoyable in the right setting.
I learned today that Cordoba has a sort of equivalent, these flamenquines, which are kind of like a cachopo cross with a Swiss roll or an Arctic roll.
It's got jam in it, or it's rolled up?
No, they're rolled up. It's pork meat, not veal, but it's got kind of rolls of ham through it, and it's also in breadcrumbs and fried. Doesn't sound very appetizing, but it comes in a long sort of roll, a long sphere, And I think one of the theories about why it's called the Flamenquin is that these look like the legs of flamingos, you say in English, don't you? Flamingos.
And have you managed...
Flamingos.
Have you managed to have any vegetables yet in Spain, Daniel?
Oh, it's a struggle. It's a real struggle every day, every night. Not much fiber, not much greenery, I must admit. Most of the vegetable and fruit content that we consume comes from wine, I must admit. Wine and olive oil, some of that high-end.
I don't know if that goes towards your five a day.
Yeah.
But it's a nice try.
I was hoping, chaps, as I teased in last night's episode, to bump into my old chum and idol, Pavel Tonkov, today. And I was hoping that he might be able to advise me on Córdoba cuisine. But no sign of Pavel Tonkov, of course, the 1996 Giro d'Italia champion, who formerly owned a hotel in Córdoba, in the center of Córdoba, very near where I'm staying tonight, near the Mesquita, the old Grand Mosque. But as we said yesterday, alas, Pavel has sold up
and gone. Well, Daniel, we'll leave you to your fruitless search for fruit and veg, and enjoy your ham on. There's lots of that, obviously. And we'll reconvene tomorrow evening.
Just a very quick one, Rich. Just a very quick one, because Daniel, you were quite anxious to get our latest Kilometre Zero about Fabio Aru out last night, weren't you? The 2015 Welter champion riding his last Grand Tour before retirement. And well, he's had an upset stomach. Maybe he's had some of the flamenco for dinner. I don't know. But he's tumbled down the GC a bit over the last 3 days, hasn't he? Lost a bit of time every day. He did finish today, but he is now lying in 25th position. Hopefully he will be able to see it through to the end of the Vuelta.
Which reminds me, chaps, I bumped into Matt Winston, the direct sportif at DSM this morning, and asked him whether today could be another day for Michael Storer at the Cycling Pele.
Michael Mick Storer.
Two stage wins already for him, and Matt sort of winked at me and said, not today. And this reminded me of how successfully DSM employed this strategy of giving their riders kind of rest days in the race in the Tour de France last year. And then I saw Storer coming quite a long way down today, so I think he'd taken it pretty easy. And Michael Storer, I'm confident he's going to win another stage, and he's going to make it three before the end of this one.
Sunday. Five double stage winners, aren't there, so far? So 12 stages and 10 of them by just five riders. Let's wrap things up for tonight, shall we? And we'll reconvene tomorrow. Perhaps a sprint stage tomorrow, are we expecting?
Definitely a sprint stage, chaps.
Great. Well, looking forward to that. And we'll join you again tomorrow evening, Daniel. I must say, enjoyed the Fabio Aru Kilometre Zero immensely. Matthew Trenton, who we've spoken about quite a lot in this episode, is excellent in that, really talking about some of the pressures facing riders now, and talking about Aru as well. Really interesting stuff from him. We hear from Aru as well. Tomorrow's Kilometre Zero, I think, will be with Tim Moore, the author of Vuelta Skelter, his retelling of the 1941 Vuelta. It's a fascinating story. And there's lots of about the Spanish Civil War in there as well. So that's coming tomorrow. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.